Thank you for listening to a reading presented by the Poetry Center of Chicago. The Poetry Center is an independent, nonprofit arts organization promoting poetry in Chicago through readings, workshops, and arts education. To learn more about the Poetry Center, to read poems by our students in Chicago Public Schools, or to donate, please visit www.poetrycenter.org.
Thank you so much. Welcome to the Poetry Center of Chicago. Good evening. We are the people who bring you language where it lives. This is the Center's 33rd annual reading series. I'm Lisa Biscani. I'm the Executive Director of the Poetry Center of Chicago. And before we get to our main event, Carlos Cupignan and Anna Castillo, I'd like to do some introductions and some thank yous. First, our Poetry Center members are really important to us. Membership support is essential for us to continue to bring an excellent reading series here. For more information on becoming a member, the one person you can speak to about it is Sarah Schroeder, who's the young lady who was at the desk when you walked in. Sarah's in charge of our membership program, donations, grant writing, and database development. And if you have any questions about how to become a member, please see Sarah. Also, each year, our Hands-on Stanzas program places poets in the schools, Chicago Public Schools, to teach poetry, reading, discussion, writing, and presenting to students of all ages. This year, the Hands-on Stanzas program almost doubled in size and is now in 60 schools. We're pretty proud of that. So this right here is Michelle Taransky. She's the Poetry Center Programs Coordinator, and she coordinates the Hands-on Stanzas program. If you have any questions about Hands-on Stanzas or how you can contribute to the program, please talk to our Michelle. We'd also, as always, like to thank our host, the School of the Art Institute of Chicago, for their continuous support of our programming. They've given us this lovely, lovely room to have the event in, and as always, we can't thank the SAAC enough for their support. But let's get to the main event, which would be Carlos and Anna. Let's bring Anna up here. Anna Castillo is a poet, a novelist, and a playwright. Her collections of poetry include I Ask the Impossible, Otro Canto, The Invitation, Women Are Not Roses, and My Father Was a Toltec. Her novels include the Mishkuala Letters, So Far From God, Peel My Love Like an Onion, as well as a collection of short stories, Lover Boys. Her play, I Have Something to Tell You, Mi Amor, was performed at the Goodman Theater in Chicago as part of the 2003 Latino Theater Festival. She is a winner of an American Book Award, the Carl Sandburg Award. She's received an NEA Fellowship, and she's currently writer in residence at DePaul University. Please welcome up Anna Castillo.
Thank you. Thank you. Buenas noches. Thanks for coming out on this windy, rainy night, Chicago night, to share some poetry with us. I'd like to thank the Poetry Center for everything, and Michelle for her helping out with the workshop we did yesterday here downtown. Of course, my old friend Cumpian, where did you go? Thank you. Thank you for reading, for coming out and sharing this evening with me. I'd like to read from a poem that got out of hand. About 2 years ago, I had thought that I had basically had stopped writing poetry, and an editor of mine asked me if I had any new poetry for a new edition of a book of poems called My Father Was a Toltec that they were going to put out. And so I looked in my files, and I found this poem that I had started a few months earlier, and started it on a cold Chicago night, something like this, only it was a few glasses of wine later in the evening. You know those nights you go home and pulled out my laptop, or who knows, got to the desk, and I started working on something, and then I promptly put it away, didn't want to look at it. Well, I took it out for this book, for My Father Was a Toltec, and I looked at it, and I said, well, I found this poem. And I said, but you know, it's very depressing. It's a very depressed poem. It's very sad. He said, well, that's okay, because some very good poetry comes out of, you know, depression. So I looked at it, and I started working on it, and I tried it. started to cheer it up, cheering up my poetry. I didn't think that I wanted to have my only poem published after so many years to come out and people would read it and think, well, she turned 50, she wants to kill herself. she's suicidal. I'd like to. So then, when I started cheering it up, of course I was feeling a lot better. This was summertime. You know how that happens too. It's summertime. And 6 weeks later, it looked like this. So it was a character. Her name is Ella. Ella, if you will, I, she. She is maybe somebody said a reviewer called her every woman, maybe every Chicana, maybe every Mexican. She's that invisible woman that we have that takes care of our babies and changes the linen in the hotel rooms and is working in the back in the kitchens. And we don't really think about her. We don't really like to think about her. We just want her to do her job and not be there. And this is who Aya is, but Aya also is much more than that. Aya in her life has discovered watercolors and paints watercolors, and she thinks and she reads books, and she raises a son on her own. And so the story is about her life, about her discovery of her watercolors. It's about her thoughts about men and about women. I like to read the beginning of it for you, and it says, "An old friend recalled a woman who sent letters from afar. She once painted envelopes with watercolors of palm trees and seashores, sealed them with a lipstick kiss. Now, 2 days past the last full moon and that conversation, I wonder where that woman went, who stretched illusions like fingertips toward the sky and farther yet. She no longer wrote, was never good with the telephone, but might a voice, though small yet clear, call out deep from deep inside one's breast? Would it tell who loved that watercolor woman best, if ever, anyone at all? I knew her as a girl, common as the rows of artichokes she picked, skin burnt like roasted almonds, but more or less clever in a city dress. It disturbs me, as it did then, how many disguises a female in bloom must pretend to defend the green bough that she is before each wind, to recall the bars, dim lighting, and cigarettes, the fact that there are always too many women with dreams that hang like cheap baubles from soft earlobes wrapped around a soon-to-fade neck, an excess of feminine humanity such that they distress the rest of us who only want to live and die, and what happens throughout life is God's prerogative." Oh God, did I really just say that? "She died," I heard. "Well, of course, they all do, as each of us will in our time. But this one took something of mine. She was not a thief. She took it without knowing. Sometimes I go from room to room looking, but it hasn't turned up. Serves me right, I guess. I only wish that she had loved me less." And so, as I say, she has a life filled with much work, mundane work, and does a lot of things in between, and meets a lot of people, a lot of characters. I'd like to share this poem. This is one of the women she meets along the way. This is called "Dangerously Happy." "Then I found out that these were my assets," Lisbeth said, cupping each of her breasts and lifting them as if she were weighing melons. Lisbeth came from Lebanon by way of La Capital, El DF, Mexico City, 21 million strong and still growing. Chilangos, they call themselves. Lisbeth was 100% Chilanga, 100% believer in Our Lady of Guadalupe, 100% Lebanese, 100% Muslim, 100% still in an arranged marriage, and 100% loca. Oh, what I could not tell you about her that wouldn't tingle your toes. Lisbeth, with hair that fell in undulations like a glazed Niagara Falls, her gold bangles from wrist to elbow, and rhinestone belt jangling when she belly danced at the restaurant where I washed dishes and threw out the trash and swept and mopped the kitchen floor and sprayed for roaches and set the rat traps and made sure there was always soap in the dispenser and toilet paper in the bathrooms, and once was almost electrocuted when the deficiente manager told me to get the blender going or else, in the midst of some big quiche order or who knows what, everyone running around like we were Maxims, and I tried to fix the cord by biting down on the exposed wires with my teeth just as one of the bussers was plugging it in, trying to be helpful. And the manager told me I was lucky he didn't fire me for that. I eventually quit. So did Lisbeth. To keep up our new friendship, we'd meet sometimes for a drink. Once after our third vodka tonic, she told me that if I really painted, if I were really serious about it, she would bring her lover over to see my work. "It's not work," I said. "God, how could the only thing I did that brought me pleasure, that let me relax, that sent me far, I do mean far, far away from everything else I did, be work?" Work was scrubbing pots the size of small metal bathtubs. Work was trying to figure out algebra equations to help my son with his homework. Work was the hideous curtains I made that ended up too short for the windows, but that at least kept out some of the winter's draft. But work was most definitely not painting on paper of fine grain when and if I allowed myself to splurge on it. Sometimes for Christmas, I'd go downtown and spend the whole afternoon selecting art supplies at the store. Only that which fell within my budget, of course, so I had to select carefully and well, like a housewife on market day, squeezing every avocado, lime, and pepper until she got just the right one. I'd come home and wrap each brush, resplendent oils, a new palette. Once I bought an easel, I put a big bow on it and left it by the tree until the 25th. "What are you waiting for?" Mijo asked, knowing himself what his presents were too, since I couldn't afford to go wrong. He'd also pick out his own. Lisbeth took off her glasses and held them up against the light. She was blind as a bat. She wiped them with the edge of her leopard print see-through blouse with ruffled sleeves. "This guy has a gallery or something. No, I think he's on a board of some sort with the Contemporary Art Museum. I don't really know him, but I got his attention, if you know what I mean. He's the one that got me out of stripping." This was when strip bars were dark, seedy places where doing a lap dance broke a woman's spirit so bad she'd have to be on heroin first. Don't kid yourself, sticking her pussy in a stinking stranger's face can hardly be any woman's idea of fun. Lisbeth said she once threw up on the bar top just from the smell of one John's breath. Oh yeah, that was another thing. Stripping was a synonym for cheap prostitution. The owner and bouncers got their cuts. Lisbeth wrote novels on the side. They all took place in Mexico City, in the fancy district of Polanco. The protagonist was a platinum blonde, like Lisbeth. Yeah, blonder than Shakira. Before Shakira, long before. Why not? Who can invent anything new in the third millennium? Lisbeth and I would meet at the redhead piano bar. Ella, la morena, Lisbeth, la güera, libanesa. Never accepted any drinks that were sent over. We just went to talk with each other. You know, like friends. It's what friends do, even women like us. Like us, alone. Lisbeth's story was unfettered by family like mine was. She had left everyone behind, although she had married an engineer who had taken a job with a company outside Chicago. He'd kept her locked in the house. It had all the amenities, including a maid from Poland, who came to clean every day. One day, Lisbeth asked permission to go shopping for a new dress. Maybe shoes to match. A purse. "Yes," he said. "Get whatever you want. Just make sure you're back in time to make my supper." He only ate their kind of food. Lebanese Mexican. is what she said. Whatever that was. Baba ganoush with corn tortillas was my ignorant guess. She took a cab and drove all around that night. She wasn't impressed with Chicago. Tame, she said, compared to the mega metropolis octopus of her birth. Remember, querida, I was not some girl from the pueblo, a village idiota wearing trenzas and huaraches who never heard of a diaphragm. I used to party all night over in La Condesa district. Now there's a city that never sleeps. My parents never knew what I did. I'd say I was studying at my cousin's and he would sneak me out with him. We did drugs together. We experimented with everything. When I was married off, he cried. No one saw him, of course. He cried in the car. He cried so hard, I said, if you don't stop, I'll run away. You can't do that, he said. You have an obligation to your husband now, to the family. Don't forget, Allah is watching you. What the chingados was he talking about? Was God watching us do ecstasy, my primito and me? What hypocrisy, I tell you, Elizabeth tapped her acrylic nails on the bar. She took a belly dancing job right away, but the tips were not enough to keep a sick cat alive, she said. Then she went to a stripper bar around Rush Street, but before she could end the drug addict or kill someone, maybe even herself, ni que Dios lo mandaría, she got out. The bored art guy was paying her rent. Someone else paid utilities, another for her clothes, on and on. Lisbeth could get away with things like that. She was wise about her assets. And when she went blonde on a whim, or an intelligent guess, she got a Porsche. I watched her rise, I watched her fall. Meanwhile, I never met the man who would connect me with the art world. It's all about timing. Sometimes you're too anxious, at others you wait too long. It's not always about luck. Although Lisbeth, who came from a city where luck was all most people could count on, ran out early on, her husband eventually caught up with her, I heard. It might have only been just hateful gossip from those who also once chambiar at the restaurant. They said she left me a package. They saw not only her husband, but two cousins from Mexico. No one laid a hand on her, but they put her in the car. I'd like to think she might be back in that big house with the Polish maid, and that one day she'll pick up the phone and call me. Some days I imagine she's back in El DF, stoned and dancing up a storm at Mama Rumba's. And still others I see her with the child, with her round button eyes and sable brown ringlets, pushing a carriage in Chapultepec Park in Polanco. But that wouldn't be her. I know she'd rather be dead. As for the package she left, it was a manuscript. 420 handwritten pages, most of it illegible. Milagrosamente dichosa, it's called. She was too happy to live. I went to, continues the story. I went to a place in my life with my son to discover these mythical Mexican women. And they're supposed to be sort of like Amazonian women, and it's one of the last of the matriarchies in this world. And they live down in the Isthmus de Tehuantepec in Mexico, in Oaxaca. And I went there a few years ago after I did a radio program with a very distinguished Mexican writer, Elena Poniatowska. Elena is from Polish heritage, and she's very tiny. She's also blonde. And in this radio program, she said, oh, the Tijuanas, they are really big. And she said, they look like Ana Castillo. And she said, except that they're very fat. She said, that's how she talks. They're very fat. She said, they used to drink pulque, but that now they drink beer. And so they do. They drink these little beers. So when I heard about these are women who hold their the family purse and run the show and run the markets, I ran running over there. And so this poem is about the watercolor woman, and it is called A Night Without Stars on the Isthmus. And if you recall, she didn't get her watercolors discovered quite yet, so she is off now to the Isthmus to discover the Tijuanas of Oaxaca. That's a costume change. Followed the sumptuous neck bone of a turtle hidden in sandunga stew. Sandunga was not an exotic dish or spice, but a robust woman, skin the color of bark, y frondosa, like a leafy tree with a wide trunk, mixed blood Zapotec, born on the isthmus of Tehuantepec. Not myth, but legendary for being so real and earthbound. Sandunga, Tehuana de mi corazón, Juchiteca, if she comes from the village of Juchitán. The women run the markets. Their children are the best fed in the republic. They are boisterous, laden with gold coins and chains and earrings, bright scarves around their necks like fortune tellers. But they are not wanderers or of mysterious origin, but indígenas, mestizas, with everything that passes through that tropical paradise. They live for the fiesta. Grind corn, bare-breasted, let gay sons wear dresses. Everyone has a job and a place, and the women run it. But it isn't true that they run their men. The sandungas administrate. There's a difference, they insist. The men don't stay home like docile love slaves, Ulysses transfixed for 7 years. They fish, make fireworks, catch iguanas, spin humongous pots. They plant and harvest lots and lots of indigo. They turn over their pay to their wives and mothers before they waste it on drink or something just as foolish. Make no mistake about it, las sandungas' feminine extravagances, satin enaguas, loose hair adorned with crowns of aromatic blossoms, as she rides by standing on the back carriage of a three-wheeled motorbike, not with an air of a queen, but with the purpose and authority of Secretary of State. Oh, so many changes for the ways of La Sandunga coming up in the name of progress, or as she would say, cutting to the chase, aye. But for a long while, the older, the fatter, the more she was praised, the more she was valued. Tell me, what could be wrong with that? Tell me, if you can, those who think of Mexicans small of build and height, small of mind and ambition, with no past to build on, no one to receive them with respect, where still they go to work, have they ever tried to bargain with the woman from Tehuantepec? They flirted that night, ella y la Ismeña at the vela. There was a party that lasted till dawn. This one was held in the name of San Blas. The people of the Isthmus are not Catholic so much, nor were they pata rajada pagans, but who they became centuries down the line, a red stain reminder on the forehead, not Hindu, flower of the trumpet vine, or hippie tattoo, but vestige of when they were branded. Baby girls and wrinkled doñas, rotund and well-formed maidens, even a pretty transvestite or two decked out to the nines, started off the outside ball without men on the dance floor. The two danced all night. She, who had taken a bus south with her teenage son, sulking alongside all the way down, and who had gone back to the hotel as soon as the fiesta began, everything so foreign as it was. In any case, an adolescent at a social event accompanied by a mother never made a happy pair. And La Sandunga, upper arms flapping to the rhythm in a firm grip, they danced with the other women too, each and every one draped like a dark velvet bell, swaying in silks, lace, and thick cloth strips, wrapped around luscious graying hair, and flowers abounding, wilting fast in heavy coastal air. With a hand on a hip, they took breaks to fan themselves and chug down beer after beer, feasting on blue tlayudas, desserts of honey-sweetened plums, smoked their own hand-rolled cigarettes, telling jokes with double entendre punchlines. What excitement among the so-called libertines, what fare! until something sharp caught in her throat. The treacherous bone sent her not to where at the end was a bright light inviting her dead relatives flagging her in like railroad signalmen, but a sublime and almost immediate arrival at a place of no return. Oh, not Tamuanchan. No mortal adult was ever sent there, but the trap door that opened at the end of all the hells of Mitlan to complete and utter elimination of the Indio soul. Those we call the Aztecs, who call themselves by many illustrious names in their heyday, but not Aztec, as the ancient Greeks did not call themselves the ancient Greeks. While the Romans, on the other hand, as also the lost tribe of Israel, still hold their ground regarding God's intention, Aztec, therefore, is not used as an archaeological excursion, but as a point of reference. Where she went, ella llegó ser Dios mismo, that is, again, get this, one with God's presence. What God? Belonging to whom? None other than the God you imagine. As everything blacked out with her final breath, she had no doubt that she had left this life and entered another. No one noticed when she fell, just as the world has never noticed when she stood. She fell by the crude wooden table like a morsel of tamal, sniffed at by stray dogs, stepped on by dancing feet. Meanwhile, get this once more. She started the journey of all jornadas, the one most difficult to explain. To the left of her brain was the band still heartily playing, while to the right a suction as soft and as an inhaled whistle of something calling. Calling, bidding her welcome. I'll take her home, her hostess announced from another stratosphere. She's had too much to drink, and everyone laughed. She could hear the laughter, ha, 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 or in Spanish, ha, ha, ha. She's drunk. Está borracha, la gringa. Yes, in southern Mexico, she was, of all things, gringa. But then, la sandunga, seeing she was not red but had turned white, stuck a fat finger down her throat to save the watercolor woman's life. Yeah, she said, pulling out the bone like a wartime surgeon working under dire conditions. She held it up triumphantly for everyone to see, passed it around. Yep, it was a turtle bone, all right. People pat her on the back, and she drank down another little bottle of beer, so proud of her victory. As if it hadn't been her fault to begin with, leaving that bone in the stew. Ella, who was slowly returning to consciousness, thought to herself, but never mind, no harm done, and what was past, soon passed. They carried her back to La Sandunga's mud and adobe home with the loom for embroidering Chinese flowers on velvet skirts, taking up most of the front room, and concrete floors dusty from open doors. In the patio, she rested on a hammock covered with a net while La Sandunga rocked it like a cradle, as if no one had a care in the world. The night without stars, while next to La Sandunga Dichosa, was a grandchild at her breast, and at the other, her happy man. While Ea drifted off, something stranger happened, stranger than even death and resurrection. Her painting's crude yet pure expression of herself, as they had always been, came to her head, one by one. Numbered and named, even alphabetized like the works of that art history class way back when, they were all self-portraits. Not a Frida Kahlo fetish, as a lover once suggested. But this was about, not about tawdry remembrances of things past, but of almost dying, even if just for a few moments on that brief vacation for which she had saved to venture to the land of her ancestors to give her half-grown son a sense of himself, and of women like the Tejuanas, Juchitecas, Las Sandungas. She hadn't, of course, worked like a burra all year just to go somewhere to die so young. Everyone thinks of herself as too young when it comes to dying. And with still too much to what? She swung slowly, easily, beneath a no-moon sky, drifting off and starting to dream of her 402 paintings. Mimishkoa, she called the collection, like 400 stars in indigo cielos. Count them. Native peoples of the Americas had always revered what came in fours. earth, water, air, and fire, spring, summer, autumn, winter, east, west, north, south. You get the picture. If you want to complete the sacred turn, you add five for the center of the universe. In this case, there were four plus two more, Moon Sister and the Jealous Brother with piercing rays, who slayed her and their 400 star sibs each and every dawn, the Mimishkoa. Every night they returned, brightly shining, tenacious as some can be. Moon Sister repaired herself in a month's time, then came back, the Brother Sun rising from the east to do them in again. Aya, smiling in her half-sleep, rocking in the welcome breeze like a ripened fruit on a branch, made a decision there and then. But like all major decisions that catalyze a transformation forever after, this one would take a while before being implemented. One must always think these things through, but not too long, or else they'll never happen. She had died, she was convinced, that balmy evening, and as she returned, apparently it must have been for a reason. She gave herself one. She would show the Mimishkoa. She would bring her paintings to the public, to the theys of the world, to see and judge who proclaimed what was what and what was definitely not. She would bring the Mimishkoa out, though they might pity the primitive use of her brush, distortion of perspectives, how she always got one eye too big, the forehead too narrow or too broad, the nose much bigger than it was on her face. She had nothing to hide or to apologize about. She had died once, and once was enough to know she could die, and that would be that. But she could not return and live without stars. Thank you. I'd like to thank the Poetry Center also for creating the broadsides. I just got my first peek at them, and I hope you get a chance. One of our Chicago-based masters of the arts did the illustrations, Marcos Raya, and I'd like to also thank him for his work. He selected this poem, and I would like to end this evening and my reading with this poem. It comes from the title of this book, I Ask the Impossible, and it's the poem that is on the broadside. It's my one official love poem. I ask the impossible, love me forever. Love me when all desire is gone. Love me with the single-mindedness of a monk, when the world in its entirety and all that you hold sacred advise you against it. Love me still more. When rage fills you and has no name, love me. When each step from your door to your job tires you, love me. And from job to home again, love me when you're bored. When every woman you see is more beautiful than the last or more pathetic, love me as you always have, not as admirer or judge, but with the compassion you save for yourself in your solitude. Love me as you relish your loneliness, the anticipation of your death, mysteries of the flesh as it tears and mends. Love me as your most treasured childhood memory, and if there is none to recall, imagine one. Place me there with you. Love me withered as you loved me new. Love me as if I were forever, and I will make the impossible a simple act by loving you as I do. Gracias. Buenas noches.